ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The world right now is a disaster. It's easy to feel helpless. But there was a moment when millions of people around the world said enough. I'm Sisson Kim Simong. Join me for Boycott, the fight to end apartheid, how Australians joined others around the world to push back against racism and won.
Whites only teams, we thought that to the average Australian, that would be despicable.
Boycott, the fight to end apartheid. Search for ABC Rewind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm Claire Nichols, and this is The Book Show, where I bring you conversations with your favourite fiction authors. Later, you are going to meet Patmina Sabit. She has written a total page-turner of a book about a migrant family, a tragic death, and the stories that swirl around this moment. But first up, it is always a good time when the Irish writing legend Colm Tobin is here. Colm is best known for his novels Brooklyn, Long Island and The Magician. And he's about to publish a new book of short stories called The News from Dublin. Colm Tobin, welcome back to The Book Show.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Tell me what you love about writing short stories.
I had a lot of trouble with them when I was starting. It wasn't until I was in my 50s that I got the hang of how to start a story. I was always starting stories with too much information, too much effort. You could see the strain. It's almost like writing a poem where you have to let the image flow. And you have to get something slow, but at the same time, it has to do some work. And that balance then is required. I think often if you think of some situation that's really ironic, or ambiguous, mm-hmm. you can get a story from it in the way that it won't fit into a novel. So I think the difference is almost complete between story and novel. And these stories have been written over the last 10 years. I have to say, when the book was coming out, I dropped a few stories, just I didn't think they were good enough. And this meant that a few stories I had drafts of or half done, I really got going. It was good. It gave me energy. So last year, I finished three of them. Mm. Three of them I had there. And that was quite exciting because it was the publication of the book. You know, people think about writers being dreamy or, oh, inspiration has to come or the moon has to change or something. But actually, it was just that I had a book coming out and I was going to be too short and I needed to put three more stories into it. I need to get up early and just do those. I mean, it wasn't that I was waiting for the idea for them. I had it already, but I hadn't done the work. So I had to sit down and really, really work on three stories in the book.
Nothing motivates you like a deadline, Colm.
That's true.
I find it fascinating that you say you got better at these in your 50s, because I was going to ask you to put on your teacher hat, Colm, and tell us why a short story is harder to write than a novel.
Yeah. You know, in a novel, you always know that you can go into backstory, you can explain the past, you can deviate, you can have someone stop for a drink. Mm-hmm. But in a short story, really, everything has to move in a certain direction. It's like shooting an arrow. But if the reader knows that or thinks that or sees it happening, then you lose the reader. So it has to use the word dreamy again. It has to look almost dreamy with no dream. It has to be wide awake. And for that to happen, first of all, actually the thing I discovered in the end really was the longer you leave an idea without writing it, right, say the opening paragraph or the opening page, the longer you leave it, the more likely it is to be good because you've thought it through all the time. It comes into your head at various times and you're seeing it in full. You know, with that opening of the book, it's a story called The Journey to Galway. I had the opening page on my laptop.
Can you just explain briefly, Colm, what that story is about?
It's basically taken from the diaries of Lady Gregory, her son. It was the subject of Yeats's poems, An Irish Airman for Assisi's Death, and in memory of Major Robert Gregory. But this is from her perspective.
About the death of a son during the First World War.
Yeah, she wakes in the morning and her son is in the First World War, and she realizes if every day is a success, you get to midnight without a telegram, then that's a great day. Each day then becomes a sort of gift, unless the news is going to come. And it does come. And she feels that she remembers everything before the telegram came in a completely different way, as though light was different, as though silence was different. I'm trying to write this down. And, you know, it's not that she was hungry and then she got fed. It's not, you know, it's not something you can measure, this idea of memory changing. But I wrote that page and then I left it on my laptop and I would read it twice a day. This is over a few months. I make little changes until I could make no more changes. And then I felt I could go on with it. I could finish the story. But I think the longer you take, the better. And the more you postpone, the better. Eventually you have to pounce, of course. You just pounce on the thing and finish it. But it's almost like being a sort of, a cat looking for a mouse, that you have to be very quiet and very patient and very watchful, and then you have to pounce.
I love hearing about the discipline of writing these stories, because it sounds like there is a real kind of diligence to this, right?
Yeah, I would have them all in my mind. And no, it's not like having children. And there's no point in a bloke telling you, oh my, writing stories is like having a baby. I know nothing about having babies. And even if I did, I know it's not like writing a story. And someone tells you something. I mean, I'll give you an example of this, that there was a historian of the Spanish Civil War, and I went to see him to interview him about something else. And he told me that he had invited a general from the Franco side, from the fascist side, to come back to Catalonia, where, you know, the fascists were never welcome, and show him where various things had taken place. Mm. And as they were walking in the streets of this village, which had been a left-wing village during the war, he met a woman on the street, an ordinary woman who was shopping. These are people who are both in their 70s now. And the Civil War is 55 years over. And the man recognizes the woman and stops and says, hey, hello, hey, what's going on? And they knew one another for that summer of 1938, where there were parties every night, where the fascist soldiers had taken over the town. And people thought they might have been in barracks all the time. But it was the summer. They were Southerners. They actually wanted to drink and dance and meet girls and do all that. And they had an affair that summer. But she'd never told anyone. And, you know, when he told me the story, I realized, don't tell me anymore. Don't tell me how it ended. Don't give me any more. And I began to imagine that summer. And I began to imagine the years afterwards. And I began to imagine the woman hearing the news that this general, she's completely put him out of her mind for very good reasons, was coming back and wanted to see her. What's she going to do that day where after 55 years, this man is going to come? And, you know, of course, she was pregnant at the end of the war. And he's the father, but she's never told anybody who the father was. And she doesn't want to see him. And she does. She does. She doesn't. She does. She doesn't. I don't know what I'm going to do. But when the man told me the story that day, and that certainly was a good 20 years ago, I realized, I have a new story. No matter what happens, I'm going to write that story.
And that was 20 years ago, but published now in this book. Had that story been published previously?
Yeah, it was in the New Yorker about a decade ago. Yeah, probably 10 years later, I'd settled down to do it. But the minute he told me, and so you want to be very careful around me.
Don't let anything slip. Gollum's going to use it and you don't know when.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
There's actually at least three stories in this collection, I think, that are set in Catalonia, Barcelona. And what's your connection to this part of the world?
Well, I drifted into Barcelona when I was 20 years old. I did my final exams in Dublin for my BA and I decided to go to Barcelona. It took a lot of convincing at home, I can tell you. I stayed there for those 3 years of 75 to 78. And then a decade later, I began to go back in the summer, back more in the winter. So I've spent a lot of time there over the years. So, for example, in the story, The Catalan Girls, where the three women in Argentina come back because they've been left a house. It's that lovely idea, you know, that you're a certain age, you're in your 60s, and someone leaves you a house that you remember from childhood. And you get a chance to go back to that house. The thing is, I know that house because I know that part of the Pyrenees. I know what the summer is like there. But I found myself using other things. For example, I went to see, there was an American photographer called Deborah Turbeville. She had a big house in San Miguel de Allende in Mexico. But she told me, oh, yeah, I have all these beautiful rooms, but what I love is sitting in the evening under the stairs. The maid has a little room with a little TV. And we both sit there and we eat food from our lap, you know, from plates on our lap. And we watch the little TV and we close the door. It's very cozy in there. I thought, what an extraordinary idea. And I put that straight into the Catalan Girls. Often you take little things from elsewhere, things you remember, or sometimes just things you imagine, and you throw them in and see if they'll stick. If they don't stick, you take them back out again. But I love the idea of this very tall, aristocratic Argentine woman with lots of money and a big house, deciding in the evening what she really wanted to do was go in with her maid and watch stupid programs on the TV late at night.
Do you write these things down, these little tidbits that you get, so you can keep them in a diary for 10 years?
No, I don't write notes. What I do is when it occurs to me, I would write the first paragraph. Mm-hmm. But with the first paragraph, the intention would be that was to stay. It wasn't a note to myself as much as the beginning of the story. I write in longhand, so I could rewrite that a good number of times. Just cross it out and rewrite and write it again and cross it out. Just wait until you see if it's right. But the notion of writing down woman under stairs, maid, television, I would forget what was that television? It's only if it's worth remembering, then it's useful. Mm-hmm. If you're going to forget it easily, then it's not going to stick. It's not going to stay.
I mentioned Catalonia, but there are other reoccurring themes across these stories, Colm Tobin. There's war and estrangement. There are explorations of ideas of sin and guilt. And there are also some really specific reoccurring motifs that I noticed. For example, people applying for bank accounts, people locked in places. When you look at this collection all together, what do you notice about what your own preoccupations or interests were over this period of time?
Look, it's really, you see, the problem is that you write it once. Say you write this. One of the key figures, I think anyone Irish knows, is the guy who runs the bar, the Irish bar in any city that you're visiting. He mightn't own the bar, or give him more power in a way if he doesn't. He just runs it. And he knows everyone coming in and out. He knows what sport to put on the TV. He knows what punters are looking for. He knows what drinks people will want. He's almost the old role of a priest used to have. There's something priestly about his role. I put him in once and then I couldn't resist it and I put him in twice. So there's one guy runs such a bar in Barcelona and I think it's called the Shamrock Shore.
Yep.
And the other one runs a similar bar in San Francisco. And they both are slightly sexually ambiguous. It's unclear what they're thinking. One of them is a real troublemaker of a certain sort, and the other is really kind and decent and watchful. But he's on Grindr all the time as well as being all that. So it was tempting the second time not to. But I thought, this figure is really important. He's taken over a certain sort of role in Irish life or Irish emigrant life. I bet there's a figure in all over Australia. There are guys like that sitting in bars, just watching who's coming in and coming out and knowing what match is coming and should be on the TV. And I just thought that it was important that this was registered finally in Irish fiction. I think any short story writer is pretty limited. You've got to be very careful that you don't. I was repeating names, certainly. I had a whole lot of Pauls and Toms, and I had to put in a Seamus, which I didn't want to do. And even I was looking at it the other day, how did that Seamus get in there? Because, of course, there were too many Pauls and Toms.
There's a story in your collection. It's called Five Bridges, and it's about an Irishman. I think he is called Paul in this case.
They're all called Paul or Tom.
He's about to return home, and he's been away from Ireland for more than 30 years. So he is really going back to a place that he doesn't know. How does he feel about going home to Ireland?
I had half that story written. I had done that hike up to Muir Woods, which is outside San Francisco. So I had all that done with the guys to be his last weekend in America, having stayed illegally. Thing is, if you leave America having been there illegally, you never get back in. Your name is on the most extraordinary blacklist on a computer. Things beep when you would appear to try and get into America again. So when Donald Trump was elected a second time, I realized I'm going to finish this story. And I'm going to have it finished by the time Trump is inaugurated. Meaning that the story, most of it happens on the last Saturday before Trump is inaugurated, when this Paul figure will go for a hike with his daughter and then he will leave America. And I worked on that very Saturday.
Wow.
I got up early and I worked all day in real time, the real time of the story. I was working on the very day the story was happening. And my aim was, I have to get this guy out of America by Monday, which is Trump's inauguration. And I have to, therefore, the story has to be finished by Monday because in the fiction I'm working with, he has to be out. So I finished the story and within a few weeks, the New Yorker published it. So it was the only time in my life I think I've been up to the minute. I'm always writing about the 1950s or the 19th century or sometime in the distant past. And people are always at me about, like, why? What's wrong with contemporary life that you can't deal with it? Like you don't even have text messages, or you don't have the internet, or all the things people, you Ryanair, all the things we, you know, Abu Dhabi. You don't put all those things into your fiction. You seem to be locked in the past. And so, well, for once, I've been really modern, really contemporary, and up to the minute.
What is it like in a moment of, I guess, anxiety for some, a moment of political change, to actually go to your writing room and set yourself a project to write about this exact moment as it happens? How does that help you deal with what's actually happening around you?
Yeah, it was one way of seeing if I could write my way out of the horror I thought was coming. And then the horror happened. The thing is that it's in the future, to try and describe the strangeness of America now, the way in which everything is taken as normal, the way in which so much has now been normalized, the way in which you could really spend a lot of time talking and thinking about many other things while around you, the casual business of, you know, someone was coming to do some work in the house. I'm in Los Angeles, and just said, well, I can't go in the morning to collect the material. And I honestly just innocently said, what's the problem? I thought it was traffic. And he looked at me, and I looked at him and said, oh, meaning that that's where ICE goes. ICE goes to the hardware stores. ICE goes, and because that's where a lot of the illegal people who are doing that sort of work that is really necessary in Los Angeles, that's where they go in the morning to collect the materials for the day. Mm. And they're like sitting ducks there. Their trucks are outside, and it can be got. And they know that, and they don't do it. So you're living casually within a world. And the problem is, of course, if that man were to be taken, he could be held for months on end without anyone knowing where he was, under the most horrible conditions. In other words, he would be held effectively without habeas corpus. He would be disappeared, and he would be held in a concentration camp. And that's actually what's happening, except that everyone is bothered about something else. So when the Epstein things happen, people then start worrying about a war. And then Trump decides he wants to buy Greenland. He wants to buy Greenland. I mean, that's just the comedy of that, until you realize, of course, that it's taking up 24-hour news cycles, his efforts to buy Greenland. What's the Danes going? What's NATO? Trump wants to buy Greenland. Of course, he doesn't want to buy Greenland. He just wants to control a news cycle with some other thing ridiculous that he wants. And you live in that. And it's an extraordinary idea. When, if you were a historian, or if you were a student of history, and you were wondering, how did things happen in Germany that Hitler got such control? You think, ha, look at what happened in America. I mean, he may not end up being Hitler, but nonetheless, the way the society went along with him, the way in which he was normalized, the way in which the New York Times will put him on the front page, looking presidential with his tie and that horrible look on his face, that he will still be called the president, but he should be called names. I would call them names, but I don't have any power.
But well, you do have some power. You are a writer. And what is the role of the writer? Can writing a piece of fiction make an impact?
I think you'd want to be very foolish to think that a story you would write could affect America in its current state. So that I think that you have to remember that it's like the difference between meat and fruit. You know, people might need meat to live. What do they want fruit for? But people do want fruit. The number of times people devote their time to growing lemons and oranges and peaches and plums. So the fiction, I suppose, is like that. It's lemons, oranges, peaches, and plums. Whereas meat, meat is the real world. It's politics is out there, and the chances of you having any effect on that. I think you try and if you think about a lemon, just how exquisitely beautiful that yellow is, and if you could work on that, just make your yellow really beautiful. And don't worry about it. Will this nourish someone? I mean, lemon juice could destroy your appetite.
Knock good for your teeth?
Yes, not good for anything. But at the same time, there's something delicious about lemon juice, or even the look of a lemon, the look of a peach. So you're involved in that, in somehow or other, dealing with the small matters of how interesting life is, how ambiguous it is, how odd it is, how dramatic it is. Life. Just life.
Tim Winton always says he's in the business of useless beauty.
So he is. I love that book of his about surfing. Breath.
Yes, wonderful,
I love
wonderful
that book of his. Yeah, yeah.
Look, I want to talk about one more story in this collection, The News from Dublin. It really stood out to me. It was called A Sum of Money. It's about a teenager called Dan. He's at boarding school and he starts pinch.
He was called Paul, by the way. He was called Paul. I had to change it. And I forgot. I didn't change it enough. So at one stage, he was still called Paul in one paragraph.
I'm glad you
the
found
it. The things that come to get you, you know, because I don't know how to do that thing on a laptop of, you know, changing a name and putting in another name instead of it. So I went through each one. But I missed one.
All right. I'm going to teach you how to do a control replace before we hang up today. But okay, he is called Dan, and I think he's consistently called Dan through the story. He's at boarding school and he starts pinching money out of other kids' lockers. Colm Turbine, do you remember how this story started?
Yeah, it happened. And it's a very long time ago. It's 1971 and it happened. And it always struck me, I wonder what happened to that guy. In other words, that somebody was stealing, things were being stolen from lockers. I was the one who saw him on the dorm, but I never told anyone. I didn't think it was any of my business and to tell anyone. But he knew that I knew. And one day he was gone and his cubicle was empty and everybody said, he's the guy who got caught. And that's how he got caught. There was a match on and he had to get some money from wherever he was hiding it so he could go on the bus with all the rest of us. And two guys started to watch him just to see where he was going to get the money from. Now, I haven't been on that dormitory. I slept. That was my dormitory, the attic. And incidentally, I put another character into the story who's out of Nora Webster. He's her son, Donal, who's also another version of me. So I have sort of two versions of me as part of the student body. But I haven't put a thought into that dormitory since, that I left for years. But I was slept in it in 1971. And so I'm back in my old boarding school, in my old dormitory, with a little story that stayed in my mind forever of something that happened, that a boy got caught stealing. And my thing is, what happened next? How did he get home? What would happen if you arrived home in a very remote rural place and news has come that you were caught stealing in your boarding school? And just say you're an only child and just say you're up a long lane in the countryside and your parents are in very remote, they have no money. What happens that night? And of course, the whole business of the short story is really good at letting nothing much happen, that the great confrontation doesn't occur, which, if to make that seem right, you can't just say it didn't occur, they said nothing. You have to bring it down slowly. But yeah, that's absolutely from memory. But the memory is of the event. What I didn't know, I had to imagine, was what happened to him afterwards.
Look, it is so wonderful to talk about these stories and get an insight into your process, Colm Turbine. Your collection is called The News from Dublin. It's out on the 31st of March here in Australia and it's published by Pan Macmillan. It's so fun to talk to you again.
Hey, thank you very much. That was great. Thank you. Thank you.
You're listening to The Book Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Claire Nichols. And I'm going to take you to America now, where a young Afghan woman, just 18 years old, is dead. And her story will be retold by the people around her, members of the Afghan community, her teachers and school friends, neighbours, investigators, witnesses, lawyers, activists and more. In this chorus of voices, the people we never hear from are those that know the truth, the woman herself and the refugee family that came from poverty to achieve the American dream before it all fell apart. The book is called Good People and it is a totally page-turning debut by Afghan-born, Canadian-based author Patmina Sarbat. Hi, Patmina.
Hi, Claire. Thank you so much for having me.
So you were born in Kabul not long after the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. How long did you live there for?
For 1 month. I was 1 month old when my parents fled the fighting.
And where did you go from there?
So we went across the border to Pakistan, where millions of refugees had fled before us. That was really one of the only pathways to safety at that time. So we went to Peshawar, Pakistan.
And how long then did it then take you to get to America?
I was around 2.5 years old when my family moved to the United States.
Wow. Okay. So you've got this incredible background, this incredible story, but I guess your memories start in America. What did you understand about your past and about your culture and your heritage growing up?
Yes. Yes. My memories do start in the U.S., in Virginia, where I grew up. But having said that, my family's story and where we came from and who we were was very much a part of my childhood and, you know, youth and adulthood, all of that. It was so important for my family, like it was for so many other families that had immigrated or who were refugees in the US and Canada and across Europe at that time, to kind of retain as much of their heritage and their values and their culture as possible. And that was certainly true for my family as well.
Mm. And so for you growing up, Patmina, you know, culturally, did you consider yourself Afghan, American, or a little bit of both?
You know, it's very interesting, because I think this is a situation for the children of so many immigrants, is that it's a very tough thing to kind of grow up in that way where you are between two worlds. So there was definitely a sense that we were Afghan. However, having, like as I said earlier, my first memories of being of the U.S. and English being the stronger language among the two languages that we spoke. And, you know, living in the United States, obviously you felt very American as well.
Mm. And could that be a source of tension between migrant children and their parents?
I think it's absolutely a source of tension as they grow older. I think when the children are young, it's a very different thing. But it's, I think, as the children grow older, and there is a sense of the children forging their own identities and wanting their own independence, and maybe not being as loyal to these bonds that their parents have with the home country, with those traditions, with those values, I think those tensions and those fault lines definitely arise.
And what about for girls? Are the expectations on girls different than the expectations on boys?
I think that within, if you are part of a community, and then even within that community, part of this family, or the smaller subset, I want to say, of people who are determined at all costs to really adhere to certain values, then yes, it is much more difficult. I would say that there is always a sense of having to be worthy of the values or of the sacrifices of your parents. I think that's true for both boys and girls of immigrants and refugee children. However, I think for girls within such communities, there is the added burden of having to carry the family name, of having to carry the family honor, of knowing that you're responsible for your family's status within that community.
So I understand this novel, Good People, it started with a news story. Tell me about this story.
Yes, that was in 2009. There had been a story in the news in Canada about an honor crime, a family that was charged and then later convicted of carrying out the honor killings of three of their daughters and another female family member. And I began following that story, as did many people here in Canada. And I should say before that, back in my college days, I had some academic research experience, because I had done an undergraduate thesis on honor killings in Jordan and the attempt by the government to deter the perpetrators by making the penalties much harsher. So I had some research, or I had done research on honor crimes and honor killings in Central Asia and in the Middle East during the course of doing that thesis. So I had some knowledge of the subject. And of course, I had also grown up, you know, within a family that, while I was very privileged and fortunate that my parents were very encouraging of me going out and forging my own identity and had a great reverence for education and encouraged me to go out and achieve as much as I could, I would say that there was still a framework of, you know, what was permissible and what was not. And so I had grown up, I would say, within that kind of a framework. And so I understood it from that personal level as well. And so from that news story, I went on and began researching other cases of other honor crimes that had taken place across the US and in Canada and Europe. And I was really struck by the way that these stories were told in the media, and also by the fact that for the most part, the voices of the communities where these crimes had taken place were absent. And so that was really where my mind began to turn and I began thinking about such a story.
So what did you notice when you were looking at media coverage of an honour crime, say, in America?
Right.
What were you noticing about the way that story was told?
Well, I was noticing that for the most part, it wasn't very nuanced. I was noticing a lot of the sensationalized coverage. I was noticing that not even just the media coverage, well, the media coverage, but the discourse around it, even the public discourse, was sensationalized and it was Islamophobic. And so I began to think about the story of not necessarily the fact, but rather the possibility of a crime, and to examine it through the voices of these communities surrounding the family, but also to examine, you know, the Islamophobic and sensationalized discourse around these crimes.
I guess there would be people who would say, well, there's not a lot of nuance needed if, you know, somebody's killed their daughter. like, what do you say to that?
I would say that there would be nuance in terms of the way that it's covered. There shouldn't be, I believe, a demonization of that community and that culture, which is what I was speaking of. And I think that there wasn't a lot of nuance there, and it's the broad brushing strokes of the whole community. And I think that is what a lot of the community, and maybe one of the reasons why those voices are absent and why those communities tend to close ranks, is that because of such coverage where complete communities and cultures and people are demonized, the story maybe isn't told in a way where dialogue can begin to take place and where the issues can begin to be addressed.
And that's, of course, where novels come in, right? This gives us space to actually, you know, look beyond right. The black and the white. So the book is called Good People. It's set in Northern Virginia, and our central family is this refugee family that really pulls itself out of poverty to achieve the so-called American dream. Tell me about this family.
Yes, the story is about the Sharafs, who come to the United States as refugees. And it's about their pursuit of the American dream and their belief in that, their unshakable belief in this American dream and their attainment of it. And then the unraveling and ultimate destruction after a terrible tragedy strikes their family.
I'm thinking about what it must be like to have this sudden wealth. You know, when this family arrives, they need the community around them to give them a kettle and pairs of shoes. They have absolutely nothing. And then the dad, you know, strikes upon a great business idea, and suddenly they are very, very, very wealthy. That must be a real kind of whiplash feeling.
Yes, absolutely. The patriarch in this family, who is Rahmat Sharaf, as I said, has this unshakable faith in the American dream, but on a level that maybe people in the rest of the community don't. And within the book, you know, it's talked about how he views these people who are satisfied with just buying a house and just having a single car as not achieving the potential or not taking advantage of the opportunities that America has to offer. And he is determined to take full advantage of these opportunities, not only for himself, but for his children. And it is not enough for him to just achieve wealth. He has to achieve wealth to at a degree that not many people can achieve. It's not enough for him that his son be a doctor. His son has to be a neurosurgeon. It's not enough that his, you know, daughter be a lawyer. She has to be on the Supreme Court. So really a man who is determined, like I said, to who really believes in the American dream to the ninth degree.
Yeah, one character comments, they became more American than the Americans. I love that line.
Yes, very much so.
And their eldest daughter, this one that the father hopes will become a Supreme Court judge, her name is Zora. Who is Zora?
Yes. Zora is their oldest daughter, and he has these great expectations, as you just said. He expects her to be a Supreme Court justice. He expects her to go to Georgetown, a great university for undergraduate, has it all planned out, and then she's supposed to go to Harvard Law School and from there to achieve these really stratospheric, amazing things. Zora, however, has other plans for herself. Or in the beginning, she does follow her father's dreams, but like many teenagers, like many young people, begins to rebel, begins to have her own ideas about what her identity is. She is more creative. She is more artistic. She's more interested in fashion and makeup. And it's really where she begins to struggle for this independence and to forge her own identity that the fault lines appear.
And we do find out in the novel that Zora has died. This whole book is told by the people around this story reflecting on this moment. It's almost like watching a documentary or listening to a podcast. You've got all these different voices telling their version of this story. Tell us what you can about what has happened to Zora.
Yes, so Zora, as you said, is found dead. And in the beginning, it is a belief that it has been a car accident. However, later, other reports come for other people come forward with more information that casts doubt onto this idea that the police had initially, that it was just a tragic car accident. And that's really central to the story is who do you believe?
And this chorus of voices, the way you tell this story is so effective. How did you land on this structure of hearing from everyone around this family, but never the family itself?
Yes. Yeah, so when I initially began writing in the very, very beginning, I didn't know that I would structure it this way. I thought that I would have a more conventional linear narrative. However, it would be interspersed with these interviews, with these voices of the community. However, after a while, I realized that the interview portions of what I was writing felt to me much more immediate. They felt much more alive, like there was fire between the words there. And the other sections of the family, the more conventional narrative to me, felt really dull, felt almost dead. And I began thinking about whether or not the story could be constructed just entirely through these interviews in the form of a documentary, a kind of a talking head documentary where the reader is stepping into the position of the documentarian or the person interrogating these people, if you will, and the family is brought alive that way. And so it presented itself as a really interesting challenge. And also because, like I said at the very beginning, I was very interested in the way these stories were constructed, the way they were weaponized, the way some people were believed and others weren't. And so it just felt to me like the perfect way to tell the story.
It's really clever because you'll be reading one person's testimony, say a friend of the parents who might say, these parents were loving and caring and took such great care of this girl. And then you might see in the very next chapter, one of Zora's school friends saying, they were so strict, they never let her out of the house. She was, you know, raging against them. It's so effective, Pat Mina, because we have to keep on questioning the way we listen to stories and we believe what people tell us, right?
Yes, absolutely. That was one of the central things that I wanted to examine is the story is told through so many different characters and so through as many different perspectives. And because of that, the reader, it's a fractured narrative. And so the reader is forced to really pick up these shards of the story and put it together for themselves. And in doing so, I think they're also challenged to examine why they believe certain voices over other voices. And really, I wanted to examine the way all of us bring our preconceptions and our biases and our prejudices to any situation, and to examine how multifaceted and complex the objective truth of a situation is, or if there even is an objective truth.
Yeah, I really found myself analyzing my own reactions when I was reading this book. I was very alert to who I was believing, who I was sympathetic to, and I don't think I've been so actively engaged in reflecting on myself as a reader for a really long time. So congratulations on that.
Oh, thank you so much. And I do appreciate that the reader has to work. And they say you always write the book the way in terms of the books you like to read. And I enjoy books where I have to work, not all the time, but I do enjoy reading books where I do have to figure things out and puzzle things together. And so I do appreciate that the reader does have to work in this book and that there are many different voices. But again, I just hope that the reader walks away with having enjoyed the way the story was told and, you know, examining these issues.
And talking about people liking it, I know this has had great reviews already, Pat Mina. You know, you've managed to get shout lines from Ann Patchett and Carla Hosseini on the front of the book. What's it been like to have such an incredible response to a debut novel?
Oh, that has been really just, and I know so many maybe debut authors say it, but just surreal on another level. I I remember when my editor asked me, she said, you know, who would be your dream writer who would, you know, read the book and give you a quote? And I couldn't dare to name those names, you know, Khaled Husseini and Ann Patchett and Alka Joshi and so many other writers who have been so kind and so generous and have seen the book.
I think I would get nervous even thinking that Ann Patchett was picking up something that I had written.
I am so grateful that they didn't tell me that they had sent it, because I 100% agree. I am so grateful that they didn't tell me that it had been sent to, you know, Khaled Husseini and Ann Patchett and the other writers that were so kind enough to read it. Because exactly as you said, yes, I would have been a wreck knowing.
Absolutely. The book is called Good People. It's written by Pat Mina Sarbat. It's published by Virago. Pat Mina, it's been great to meet you today.
Thank you so much, Claire. Thank you so much for having me.
The Book Show is made by me, Claire Nichols, with production this week from Anita Barrow. We make this show on the lands of the Wurundjeri and Whadjuk Noongar people. And for more interviews with your favourite fiction authors, make sure you're following The Book Show on ABC Listen.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.